Good evening. It's a privilege to be here. And just a little bit about me is I originate out of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Would have lived there for 38 years. And, well, 37, actually 36, 37 years right in there. 2008, we moved to Plain City. And I would have served 4 years as a marriage counselor there at Deeper Life. And then 2012, would have taken over administrative duties. Tonight's topic is Blueprint for Family. I'm not sure what you think about when you think about family. There's a lot of questions today out there as to what is family, what does family look like, or is there such a thing as family? Culture has fragmented incredibly in my lifetime. And tonight we're going to look at what is the blueprint? In other words, is there a blueprint? Or are we on our own when it comes to figuring out as to what is family? But moving into some definitions. When we think of a blueprint, here's a definition for it: a detailed plan or program of action. 1975, the Bongkuo Dam in China, at least that's if that's how it's pronounced, failed and was considered one of the worst engineering disasters at that time. This dam is largely a forgotten legacy now, but in 1975, it was named the Iron Dam and was well known as an unbreakable engineering wonder. However, disaster struck and claimed the lives of an unprecedented 230,000 people in the calamity. Furthermore, at least 11 million people were forced to relocate after the catastrophe. This disaster also resulted in a staggering economic loss that cost the country $1.6 billion. There's a number of reasons why the dam collapsed. One of them was unsafe construction. A blueprint is a detailed plan or program of action. And had they followed the blueprint and done it according to specs, that dam would have been far safer. Let's look at some definitions for family. And I have three definitions. The basic units in society traditionally consisting of two parents rearing their children. Secondly, any of various social units differing from but regarding as equivalent to the traditional family. And thirdly, a group of individuals living under one roof and usually under one head. Now my question is, as you look at these definitions, which one of those Or all of those, could possibly all those definitions be a Christian family? They could be. But they also may not be. So what makes something Christian and what makes it not Christian? Because I would consider, and the reason I'm saying that is I would consider that three adult siblings living in a home, I would consider them as a family. And so we see there's a variety of parts that can consist and make a family. But those parts do not make it a Christian family. It's more than that. And so what we're going to do this evening is, first of all, I am going to begin with just an overview of culture and cultural changes and views that have come through the world in the last, essentially, 200 years. Now, I'm going to condense it. It's going to be very condensed. And then we're going to look at, actually, what is a Christian family? What is the blueprint that God has given? First, when we look at worldviews, what we are talking about is a set of foundational beliefs from which we view reality, make sense of life, and the world in which we live. That is a worldview, a set of beliefs. First, we're going to look at the modern worldview, or the modern view, and what that is this would have occurred approximately here, as it says here, during this era, the 18th, 19th, and into the 20th century, science became the source of truth and the means by which reality is defined. Religion and morality were lowered to the subjective realm. Truth is discovered through observation and experimentation. That is the modern view, and it began with the Age of Enlightenment and carried into the 20th century, and only would have transitioned somewhat into the background in the late 1900s. Here is a quote that states as to defining the modern worldview. Modern worldviews attempt to achieve liberation from imposed, oppressive, frequently religious, and authorities and understandings of the past through an emphasis on rationality and critical thinking. The vision of reality tends to be secular and materialistic. The existence of a higher power, divine reality, or intangible dimension is generally rejected. Science is frequently seen as the ultimate and even exclusive source of reliable knowledge, providing access to the objective reality. So what does that mean? What it means is that God is irrelevant. That's what they're saying. God is irrelevant, and ultimately man is God. Science, in essence, became the Bible. Science is a source of truth and the way by which we define our world. Here's a quote from the Humanist Manifesto. Any account of nature should pass the test of scientific evidence. In our judgment, the dogmas and myths of traditional religions do not do so. So to a modern person, science is their Bible. It defines reality. It defines truth. Thirdly, it also means that they embrace materialism. Essentially, what is materialism? Materialism says that man is a physical being only. That's what materialism is. Man does not contain a moral nature. He is a material being alone. We tend to think of materialism as money and things, but yes, that's accurate. But when they're looking at materialism and worldviews, it's a rejection of a moral nature. That man has a moral nature, and that he is a spiritual being. In this era, we see a lot of philosophies that are around today were birthed. We have evolution, communism, you would have your modern psychologies, and psychiatry. Men such as Charles Darwin, Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud, Alfred Adler, Carl Jung, B.F. Skinner, Abraham Maslow, were in this era. And all of these men were either materialist, atheists, agnostics, or spiritualists. In other words, spiritualist was a Satanist or a witch. That's essentially what they were. But one thing of the modern era is that society as a whole still maintained its spiritual and moral foundations. Okay, now God was not center. He was irrelevant, but the traditions of society continued to be based in moral and biblical principles. And so we see that as we come through the 1800s, 1900s, into the 20th century, there still was a basic religious structure to society. But in the 20th century, in the 1900s, is when we see that really begin to break down. Secondly, the postmodern view. Richard Rorty summarizes postmodern philosophy well. We should give up the correspondence theory of truth and start treating moral and scientific beliefs as tools for achieving greater human happiness rather than as representations of the intrinsic nature of reality. Now, that may sound confusing, and that's because it is. Let's go on. Here's a quote from Arthur Jean Vieth, sums all this up by saying, postmodernism is a worldview that denies all worldviews. In other words, it's anti-everything. It's a philosophy that explodes all comprehensive systems without offering to build anything new in their place. In place of purpose, design, logic, and meaning, it affirms and embraces uncertainty, anarchy, chaos, and chance. It considers any effort to impose order upon the world or human life as purely provisional and arbitrary. It asserts that truth can vary from person to person and group to group. This kind of began to hit the scenes in the 60s, the hippie movement. That's when you began to see postmodernism. And it really hit the mainstream in the late 80s and in the 90s. And what does postmodernism believe? The individual is God. I am God. It promotes extreme individualism. It goes on to say that there is no such thing as universal objective truth. Everything is relative. So what this means is that language only means what the hearer interprets it to mean. So if I say the cat is red, and you decide to interpret it as it means the pig is pink, that's what it means. Language has no objective meaning. It's whatever you decide that it is what it means. They go on to say that there is no reality. The world as you see, what you see here is not reality. It's just kind of something. It's whatever you think it is. That's what it is. That's postmodernism. Anything goes, and nothing is certain. Each to their own. That's what it stands for. Within postmodernism is where you come into the fact that gender is a product of culture, not biology. That's postmodernism. Because there is no absolute truth. Gender is whatever you think it is. And what you think it is fine for you. It's not fine for me. I think it's this, but you better not interfere with what I think. So in other words, do they believe in each to their own? No, they don't. Postmodernism is anti-authority, anti-tradition, anti-religion, anti-institution, anti-establishment, anti-anything. That is postmodernism. Whatever is in place in the previous generation is to be rebelled against and thrown off. That's what they believe. Let's look at a Christian view. A Christian worldview is more than a religious belief system. It is a comprehensive view of the world from a biblical standpoint. Therefore, a Christian's view of the world should be an integrated whole comprised of a number of distinct biblical elements. Indeed, each Christian should filter his or her day through a pair of biblical spiritual goggles and see the world as a harmonious set of beliefs and perspectives. That's what we as Christians believe. And within this, we see that Genesis 1:1, which I say are the six most important words in the Bible. In the beginning, God created. That establishes the whole basis of absolute truth. That establishes the basis that there is a God. That establishes the basis that this God created the heavens and the earth. That implies everything that exists is created by God. And we speak there, it speaks of the Spirit moving on the face of the deep. We see there implications of the Trinity. We also, Christianity believes that truth is absolute and that Scripture is the complete, divinely inspired, inerrant Word of God. We find that in 2 Peter 2, 1, or 1, 3, and 4, and also 19 through 21. And that means it contains all the answers and remedies needed for man's spiritual condition in his world. It provides the foundational principles and establishes the boundaries that guide all aspects of man's physical world. It is given in the context of the spiritual dimension of man and his physical dimension. Christians also believe, and especially we would believe, that God created man as a free moral agent who through unbelief and disobedience fell into sin, bringing to depravity and death on the human race. And we find that in Genesis 2 and 3. So within this, man is created in the image of God. Men, women, and children are equal in personhood, but distinctly different in roles. The feminist movement was an argument for equality, but the reality is, in a Christian worldview, they had equality. The argument was not equality, it was actually the breaking down of the authority structures. We also believe that civil and religious institutions in the church were established by God. They are authority structures. And so quickly, that's a quick view of some of the modern worldviews. Let's move into a cultural view or cultural views of family and the modern family. This is what is typically considered the traditional family model: husband, wife, and children. That's the traditional model. And that was the modern family as a whole. There were still traditional roles, and there were still religious principles and foundations. Pew Research would have stated that in 1960, the dominant family form was two parents with children. Now, 87% of children lived in a traditional family home. Two parents, children. 73% of that 87% were first marriage. 1960, only 14% were divorce and remarried situations. Within this era, the modern era, there's been a number of changes. First of all, we see an erosion of biblical-based traditions and principles that guide society. The traditional family has a somewhat of a religious form. But we have to note that in this time frame is where we saw the erosion of those spiritual foundations. Within this time frame, we saw the rise of what I'll call the professional. And what I mean by that is the common average person is no longer capable of doing normal things that normal people do. You need a professional to do this. You're struggling, you need to go to a counselor. You're doing this, you need a professional. This would have seen the rise of the professional in this era. Within this era, we also begin to see the abdication of parental responsibilities. It correlates with the rise of the professional. And you see the abdication of parental responsibilities where teaching and training became the responsibility of the church, the school, or professionals. It was not my responsibility as a parent. We also saw breakdown in marriage roles. There were career mothers. They worked outside of the home. They were a homemaker and also had a full-time job. Within this is where you see child-centered home becoming the norm. And what a child-centered home is where all of life in the home revolves around the child. The soccer mom. Those are typically child-centered homes where they're busy taking the children to all these things. But really, they have no time with the children. Loving care over high expectations, lack of consequences. Also, we saw common law marriages, divorce and remarriage entered the picture. And we also have equal and reverse rule marriages in this time frame. Moving into the postmodern family, I'll read to you a school course, okay, on family. Change was the accepted norm for tests at home. For one thing, she had no idea who would be there when she walked in the door. Her full brother, one of her step or half-siblings, her old mom, her new old mom, or the guy her dad was in a relationship with now. One constant was Grandpa. Tess loved to listen to the old stories he told about how families used to be one mom, one dad, two children, and a dog. These stories seem quaint now compared to the reality of her diverse and rapidly changing family. Yoga was a good way to center herself in light of constant shifts, but sometimes even that wasn't enough to quell the sometime chaotic nature of her postmodern home. It goes on to say that she is living in an age where the boundaries that restricted marriage and belief in the modern world have been eclipsed by new realities and norms. Postmodern family theory can be defined as a rejection of the ideas that there is universal progress in human history, that rules and norms are static, and that means apply to everyone in the same way, and that family is the basis for learning about self. In other words, postmodern society sees rules and rules as flexible. No absolutes. That's a postmodern home. Does that sound familiar? Isn't that what we're seeing today? That's what we're seeing. That is a postmodern home. Within this postmodern family, we see that the social it is a social unit. There's gay marriage, cohabitation, and single parents. The reality is now, it is the first, I think in 2014, less children were raised in two-parent homes than were raised as single moms or in cohabitation homes. I think 46% of children have two parents. Okay, forget divorce and remarriage, have two parents. The rest are either single parent or it's cohabitation or who knows what. They're with grandma, who knows. Changes in the family, one of the things we're seeing is the denial of gender absolutes. See, postmodernism believes gender is a culture thing. It's not actually biological. Gender is whatever you think you are. We have open marriages, and what we see with that is a relationship with two people. It's multiple people in a marriage. They can be gay, or they can be straight. Can be. It's just total, however. One situation, there was one man and two women. That was a marriage. That's an open marriage. Or you have group marriages where there's multiple partners or people in this marriage. What we have seen is a total rejection of religion, a rise of socialism and atheism and Gnosticism, and a complete breakdown of community and family. Right now, the broader culture is experiencing an incredible drug epidemic. Suicide rates are climbing. Why? Man was not created to live in chaos. Postmodernism is chaos. Thirdly, the Christian family. Genesis 1, 1 and 2, Ephesians 5, 21 through 6, 4. Just a number of things I'll mention here, and then we're going to expand. Is a God-centered social unit is what we believe a Christian family is. It can be a God-centered social unit consisting of husband, wife, children. Occasionally, we will see a single parent, whether it's because of death. There's a variety of reasons. Unfaithfulness, we do see single parents. I consider that a Christian home if it is a God-centered home. We see that in the Christian family, scriptural principles provide structure and guide its operations. There's marriage roles. There's corporal punishment. There's distinct teaching of authority. There's an active Christian faith. And within this, we see that marriage, a Christian family, is a place of structure, stability, safety, and love. Quickly, just a couple views on views of children that we're going to see today. Psychology Today says this: I don't want to trivialize the roles of adults in children's lives, but truth be told, we adults greatly exaggerate our roles and our theories and beliefs about how children develop. We have this adult-centric view that we raise, socialize, and educate children. Certainly, we are important in our children's lives. Children need us. We clothe, we feed, clothe, shelter, and comfort them, but we don't raise or socialize or educate them. They do all of that for themselves. What do you think of that? Here I thought I had an impact, actual impact on my children. I was wrong. Or isn't that how it is? See, children today are a commodity. They're here to make my life easier or to give status. In the world of trafficking, they exist for personal gratification. They're tissue for research. They're a nuisance or a hindrance. Most people give 2 to 4 reasons as to why they have an abortion performed. 40% say they're not financially prepared. 36% say it's bad timing or unplanned. 31%, I don't want to have a baby with this guy. That's the reasons for having an abortion. And the list goes on. They're a nuisance. For the Christian, we find in Psalms 127, 3 through 5, a gift and a blessing from God. Lo, children are a heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hands of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate. They're a protection for us as parents. Not be ashamed, speak with enemies in the gates. That's a protection. They are a protection for us. And also, when carefully aimed and shot, arrows in the hands of a mighty man, a warrior. When aimed and shot, carefully shot, they will have a tremendous impact on future generations. Because an arrow goes where the archer, the shooter, is not. Continuing on into parenting, some common modern views is that children are good or morally neutral. And I forgot, and Vonda thought it was good because she figured I'd make a mess if I did. But I was going to bring some food coloring, and I was going to have water up here. So this is a nice glass of water, isn't it? The implications of good or morally neutral means that this is how a child is born. And they only become bad because their environment is evil or they've experienced something bad. Modern repressed memory therapies or counseling approaches man's or emphasizes man's problems or the result of childhood events. Correct the childhood events, you have now resolved the child's problems. Secondly is, which is postmodern, well, both of these we see today, is that the child is full. You notice that statement I read? They figured out by themselves. What are they saying? The child has everything they need, and they will figure it out. They're full. The parent is to be uninvolved. They allow them to sort things out themselves. Now listen to read this. If your child, who was assigned male at birth, repeatedly insists over the course of several months that she is a girl, then she is probably transgender. Call your therapist for help. That's the concept. They're full. They must decide it themselves. Or they are a cracked tank. All their problems in life or the problems in life stem from unmet needs. We have a need for significance, security, value, love. And if we're not receiving those things, we're spiritually dysfunctional. That is some modern, common modern views. What is the Christian belief? Christian says foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. Proverbs 22:15. Proverbs 22:5. Train up a child in the way that he should go. And when he is old, he will not depart from it. That's what we as Christians believe and addresses all areas. And we'll expand on that as we go on. So who decides? Who decides what is truth? Modern man says we find insufficient evidence for belief in the existence of a supernatural being. Therefore, no deity will save us. We must save ourselves. That's taken out of the humanist manifesto. That's what a humanist believes. We must save ourselves. That's what man says. Scripture says, or a Christian says, in the beginning, we go back to Genesis 1, God created the heavens and the earth. And that sets the basis and the foundation for everything. So, some guiding principles as we look at the Christian family. Who were you? Who were you? Proverbs 22:15 says, and I'm going to put it in my own words, a child whose heart was tied up by folly slash evil. Because when you look at the word folly, it is taken from the Hebrew word evil. So in other words, a child is enslaved to evil, according to Proverbs 22:15. So we see that children come with fallen natures. A child is not born neutral or good. He is innocent, but he is full of evil. And this is an absolute when it comes to parenting. Because where we start defines where we end. If we begin with the child as good, we will not end up in a place with a child that fears the Lord. Because he has no need of salvation. He is a product of his environment. Romans 3 makes it clear, Jeremiah 17:9 as well, that everyone has a fallen nature. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? If you ever think about what that verse says, it gets scary. The heart is deceitful above all things. That puts it up on par with Satan and its ability to deceive. Secondly is, who are you? Ephesians 4, 1 through 6, and actually into verse 7, tells us that, first of all, we're a child of God by adoption. Now, I don't know if that's something to get excited about, or isn't it? Or is it, do we get excited about that, or is that just, it's just, whatever. That is something to get excited about. How many times do we think of the fact that we are a child of God? And that adoption gives us access to, in verse 7, the riches of His grace. In verse 11, an inheritance. We have something to be passionate about. But how often are we? Who are you? A child of God with access to the vast riches of His grace. And an inheritance that is incomprehensible. That's ours. Let's convey that passion as we parent. Thirdly, what is family? A family is one husband, one wife, till death do us part. And that unit may include children, if God blesses it with children. According to, as we look at family, we do recognize there are single-parent homes, but we're looking, as we look at tonight, we're looking in particular at God's design, beginning in creation, of the structure of the home. And in a fallen world, there will be gaps. There will be, at times, something missing. And I don't want to throw those people to the curb. The reality is within this. Within the place that you are, there is much that can be gathered from this for each. And we have to unfortunately include biological man and woman today. One biological man and one biological woman for life. That is a family. And we see that in Genesis 1, 26 through 28 and also chapter 2. Verses 21 through 25. And then lastly, in this part of guiding principles, is who is where. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 3 says, "But I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is man, and the head of Christ is God." Who is where in this family? We have God. We have Jesus Christ. We have the husband or father, we have the wife or mother, and we have the children. Now, no one here does not mention children, but we do see in Ephesians chapter 5 and 6 that he gives the order of husband, wife, children. And within the commands, we see that they are under the parents. This does not speak of inequality. It speaks of equality in personhood, but a distinct difference in operation for the functioning of the unit. And whether you like it or not, it's absolute. You cannot get around it. It is absolute. You can deny it. You can live without it. But the reality is, that doesn't change it. Let's move into designed by God. His purpose. What is God's purpose for the family? In Ephesians 5, verse 27, we find there he speaks of that he might present it to himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. Verse 26, that he might sanctify it and cleanse it. So in other words, God's purpose for family is it perpetuates, and in verse chapter 6, verse 4, perpetuates our Christian faith. It passes the faith of the parents to the children. Bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. It also is a physical representation of the relationship of Christ and his church. Husbands, wives, if people look at your marriage, what do they see? Do they see a representation of Christ and his church? Or do they see something else? It's to be a representation of Christ and his church. And the third point here is sanctification of each person within the family unit. And what I have here is just a quick overhead to show that God, okay, we've said God is sovereign over all, right? And so within that, what is one of God's significant purposes of family is for the sanctification of each individual in the unit. And that means they're made holy. So we have situations that occur in everyday life. Strike the heart of each individual. And within that, we see various components. We have feelings, we have will, we have choice, thoughts, there's goals, plans, motives, desires, and ultimately the belief structures. And from that whole structure, all those components flow our behaviors. And what I did attach to the handout is a heart model that gives more detail to it. I'm not going to look at that tonight, but you can see that more detailed as to how God works in family for the sanctification of the individual. And so when we experience something like this, you know, Johnny is about ready to strangle Sally. For parents, how many of you does that kind of look familiar? We look to right there. There's obviously some problems going on, isn't there? What's God up to? God is working to redeem your family, each person in it. His word speaks into the situation. His Holy Spirit moves within. And the whole purpose of God is using those children to redeem and sanctify the parent. And God is using the parent to sanctify the children. And it all happens in each life situation that we experience. He is working to sanctify, to make his bride holy, which means, as we look at this as a family unit, to make the family more like him. And he uses each person. The shenanigans of the children bring to the surface the things of the heart, perhaps at times in me and as a parent, that I need to repent of and change. Those wrong responses. As I see them, I seek God's forgiveness. And as I see it repeated, I learn to identify certain things and I work to change them. God is using that child to change me. And at the same time, he's using me to change that child. That's one of his greatest purposes of family, is the sanctification of the unit to make them more like Christ. Let's look at roles, in particular for the husband. In 1 Corinthians 11:3, we see that he is the head, which means he is in front of or over. Headship brings order. Each has its function. They overlap, but they do not work separately. They work together as a unit. You can take leadership out of a home And if the mother is in her place, the home can function. But you take that home and you reverse roles, and it's an absolute disaster every time. But they're all made to work together in His order. He has delegated the authority. He is under authority. He is under God and Christ. And so, He hasn't earned it. It's not because I am such a great fellow. It's because God has chosen to say, okay, men, you're the leader. And by the way, He said, it is not good that you should be alone. How many wives would testify to that? You don't have to raise your hands. That when a husband is at home for a week without a wife around, things generally go downhill. And I think God saw that and said, whoa, we got a problem here. We have to create Eve. But remember, there's a headship order here. But the reality is, He is under authority. And the whole thing of it is, you as a husband, as a father, you must submit to your own rules. You know, there's a rule in our home, or we try to uphold it most times, is that they're supposed to eat what's on the table. And even if they don't like it, without complaining. And Vonda didn't know this for many years, but one time she might get tired of hearing this too, but she had made porcupine balls or whatever it was, and she made a mistake in making them. I think she had mixed the water or something with the crumbs, and lo and behold, we had a casserole. And unfortunately, at that time, we didn't have a lot of children that I could feed it to. And so I remember for a week, I'd open my lunch, and I was like, oh, not this again. And finally, Friday, I said, God, I can't help this. I can't do this anymore, and I threw it in the trash. She didn't find out about that for probably about 10 or 15 years, or maybe even longer than that. I never told her. The reality is, if the rule is the children eat what's on the table without complaining, it means you do too as a husband. You must submit to your own rules. If you have decided that the wife is the one who does the grocery shopping, she decides what meals to make, what to buy, groceries to buy, you allow her to do that. You have given that authority to her, and you let her do it. He also is the servant leader. And I think too often we lead like this little story. The question is, what is a leader? A little field mouse was lost in a dense wood, unable to find his way out. He came upon a wise old owl sitting in a tree. Please help me, please, wise old owl. How can I get out of this wood? Said the field mouse. Easy, said the owl. Grow wings and fly out as I do. But how can I grow wings? Asked the mouse. The owl looked at him haughtily, sniffed disdainfully, and said, don't bother me with the details. I only decide the policy. Is that a leader? No, it's not. You see, we are called as husbands to be a servant leader. Well, Ephesians 5 doesn't say that, does it? Well, think of what it says. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. That's a servant leader. He leads an act of humble love. And a husband, a father, should do all the chores his children have to do at some point or time. He should do that. He should do those things. He seeks his wife's input on decisions and helps around the house. He forms his plans to fit those under him whenever possible. He leads out in discipling and handling the hard cases. He establishes the order and isn't off duty when he's at home. He leads out in family worship and is actively involved in the spiritual journeys of those under him. That is a servant leader. For the wife, Genesis 2, 18 through 24, we see that she is designed to be a helpmeet. And what is a helpmeet? A helpmeet, according to the Hebrew is, and the Greek, is to surround, protect, aid, or help, succor, come to the rescue. And it speaks of, in the Hebrew there is, God is a helpmeet. Many times we'll find God compared to a helpmeet. So he surrounds, protects, aids, helps, succor, comes to the rescue. God created a helpmeet. Now, helpmeets can operate like this one. A woman is accused of firing a gun during an argument with her husband. She said she was angry he wasn't helping around the house, but she wasn't trying to shoot him. Officers arrested 50-year-old Starlene Roth on Saturday for investigation of attempted first-degree murder, but her lawyer said the police report didn't show that Roth was trying to kill her husband. The couple has been married for more than 30 years. According to probable cause documents, the husband had recently returned from treatment in the hospital for ongoing medical conditions. He said Roth was upset that he hadn't been able to do anything around the house. During the argument, she reportedly broke a glass vase, knocked over the barbecue grill while the husband was cooking ribs, and broke the TV remote. In an interview with police, Roth said she had a lot on her plate. She blew up. Now, notice she was upset he wasn't helping. And so she decided to help him get motivated to help. Is that a helpmeet? I don't find anything there about protecting. She did ultimately, and someone else had to come to the rescue. A helpmeet is one who makes her husband her priority. She's here to give direction. She helps by encouraging him. And for the children, in the roles for children, as you see Ephesians 6, 1 through 3, what is the function or role of the children in the home? It is to assist in the function of the home according to their individual capabilities. They are to assist in the function of the home. And it is transitional. As they grow and mature, it does change. Responsibilities for the husband. He is commanded first and foremost to love his wife. We as a family are observing that. My mother, who is 77 or 78, I think might be 78 actually, has Alzheimer's, vascular dementia. And she is currently, I would say, mentally in the state of a toddler living in an adult body. So my father, it's amazing to watch him care for her. He cares for her essentially 24/7. Gets her to bed in the evening, tucks her in. In the morning, he gets her up, he baths her, he dresses her, he helps her go to the bathroom, he cooks breakfast, he gets her in her chair, he washes the dishes, he does the wash, he does all the work around the home. And then he answers the same question about every 30 seconds. For us as a family, it is a reward. Because for my father was absent in the home essentially for 40 years. Yeah, he was present, but he was not involved. And so to see him step up like this and care for mom is a blessing. But it does come with grief in watching mom fade away. We've lost her in many ways. Love her as Christ loved the church. Husbands, do you realize that when we love as Christ did, we have to die? Not physically, but we have to die to our desires. Love the church as Christ gave himself for it. He died. We have to lay down our dreams, our goals, our desires for the betterment of our wife and our home. Put away your dirty wash. When you plan a vacation, do what she wants. Secondly, you have to provide for her. 1 Timothy 5:8. But if any provide not for his own, especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. Provide means to provide in advance, both spiritually and physically. It means to strive to know and understand her. 1 Peter 3:7. Live with your wives according to knowledge. It means you protect her and look out for her well-being. And how do we do this as a husband? We protect her by enforcing that all respect her. The children must know that disrespect of mom is not accepted. That is a way of protecting her. When she is wrong, respond in a way that recognizes her humanity but protects her position and dignity. She is human. She will fail. Secondly, a husband provides and protects for his wife by developing disciplinary structures in a way that protects her, again, dignity and authority. You delegate only what she can handle when it comes to discipline. And then active involvement in what needs discipline, how to discipline, and actually discipline. In other words, you keep her involved in it. Does this need discipline? Yeah. Okay, well, let's take care of it. But the husband leads out in it. He develops daily chore lists to provide order for the home and also in maintaining the atmosphere of the home. Children know what they are to do and who they will answer to if they don't. In other words, we have chore lists. Monday, we had this more when our children were younger, but Monday morning, so-and-so washed the dishes, so-and-so dried the dishes, so-and-so did this. Lunch, it was all set up. They looked, this is what they're to do. If they were problems with it, then dad would get involved. Generally went better if he didn't. But provides structure. It reduces her load and makes it easier for her. Make work lists if the children have too much free time. Idleness is a devil's workshop. Give 8, 10, 12-year-olds too much free time, and usually not a lot of good happens. And so develop work lists. Redirects their energy in productive ways. Doesn't mean they can't play, but have a work list. You see, hey, for this, and this needs done today, and follow up, make sure it gets done. He protects and provides for her by actively teaching biblical principles to all in the home and by developing a family altar and leading out when you're at home, or also if a father's away, direct a child to be in charge of family devotions and let them know that. Living with her in an understanding way in 1 Peter 3:7, understand her strengths, weaknesses, tired, encourage her to take a nap or help get the work done. Manage the atmosphere in the home. Dress sibling tensions when you come home and you can tell children are just at each other. It needs to be addressed. That's your responsibility. Pay attention to her feelings. And for the wife and her responsibilities, she is to submit. And submit means, in 1 Peter 3:1 through 6 there, and also in Ephesians 5:33 would speak of respect. It means, taken from the word hupotasso, which means to be over, which is hupo, tasso, to arrange in an orderly manner under. So it's to be over and to arrange in an orderly manner under. And so a wife is to cultivate a submissive spirit. And it's ordered, the order of submission is to God first, then to her husband. And it is commanded by God. Now, something for husbands to note is that submission is the wife's responsibility. It is not the responsibility of the husband to make her submit. It is her job. The husband is to focus on making himself easy to submit to. If someone says to me, well, my wife just doesn't submit to me, and then I ask her, well, first of all, I say, well, why should she? And then, how is how you're living, do you make it easy for her to submit or hard for her to submit? And then also, okay, tell me what submission is. And many times, it's not an issue of submission. It's an issue of leadership. Submission never requires her to violate God's commands. If you want to see a beautiful picture of submission, turn to 1 Samuel 25, and we won't do it tonight, and look at the story of Abigail. And within we see a picture of submission. She's honest. When she approaches David, she says, look, I know he acts like his name, which is a fool. She was honest. She said, you know, this man is a vile, evil person. He is. But she appeals. She recognized his authority over her. But then she appeals to David in the name of God, essentially. And she goes and points out to David how God is blessing him, how he is protecting him. And ultimately she says, when you're king, if you do what you're planning to do, you're going to regret it. That's in essence what she said to him. And then she went home, and once Nabal was sober, she told him what had happened. We see there the model of submission. And we do need to bring it to a close. We have also here is for the wife is respect. What does respect look like? Don't talk about his faults or contradict your husband before your children. One of the things to think about is that when children come to a parent with attitudes about the spouse, and you find it happens again and again and again, the question that you need to ask is, why are they doing this? Because there's a distinct possibility that they're picking up the same issue in your life. I recently read an article to church leaders, and one of the things they said, don't consider it a good thing when all the people under a certain leader come to you with complaints about that leader. Said there is a very distinct possibility that in some way you're facilitating that disrespect. And you need to search out carefully as to why are they doing this. There must be something I am doing that fosters it. If they bring complaints about wife or a father, make it very clear, one, as we said, give allowance for their humanity. But then make it clear of what are you doing about it? Are you submitting? Are you doing what you're supposed to do? Also, we see then that, well, with that is respect is the attitude of obedience. Treat your husband as more important than your children. Encourage, don't scold, but be honest. Then we look at obedience. It's the action of respect. What does obedience look like? Obedience means you enforce the structures he has established for the home. He has given you an active role in developing them. Now it's obedience is also enforcing them. He has given you that authority. It also means doing what he says, even if you don't feel it is necessary. And lastly, just looking at the children, Ephesians 6:1-3, they are commanded to submit, which means there is to obey from under. Children are to obey, place themselves under the authority of their parents. And they are to obey, which does not imply submission. It says simply do what you're supposed to do. The house rules that are established, the chore list, the work list, you are to obey them. Obey the structure as it is in the home. How long? It would vary. The Old Testament would seem to point to 20 years as a significant age, but the reality is today an 18-year-old is considered an adult. I don't know that it matters. We do have some point at which we consider that. And lastly, they're to honor, which means esteem their input, advice. 1 Timothy 5:4 would say, but if she has children, he's speaking to a widow here, or about a widow or grandchildren, their first responsibility is to show godliness at home and repay their parents by taking care of them. Now, that's the New Living Translation. What is esteeming or honoring your parents? It means in their old age that you take care of them. That's something I've really questioned today. I'm not saying there's no place for nursing homes. But let's remember, they have cared for us. We are to repay them for what they have done. In closing, which one of the family models we discussed tonight describes your home? As I pondered the various models of family, the one that struck me was the modern family, the traditional family model. Is God the center of your home, or is he in the periphery? So many times, in the busyness of our lives, we give too little thought to God. And then we wonder why things happen. Let's make our home a Christian home, where God is the center, God is worshipped, and he dictates all aspects of our life. That's the home that is safe, that is secure, that is a place where people want to be. And that home will speak volumes to a postmodern culture that knows no home when they see its stability, its peace, and its function. Let's bow our heads in prayer. Father, we come to you tonight, and Lord, we